You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, presented by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool.
I want to be the title sponsor. What's it going to cost?
I think around 10 million.
Yeah, I that's a bit out of my budget.
I have the impression that we are in the place where we have to be now.
Greg had a really bad back all last week. So we caught up on your podcast with me giving him a back massage and him listening to you guys.
Oh, that's a wonderful image.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I am with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
No fancy job titles this week, chaps. I think you've been sacked already, Lionel, as head of Winning Behaviours.
Doesn't surprise me whatsoever.
Anyway, let's crack on. We're going to do a briefer than usual episode this week because we've got our second Friends special of the year being released. That's on HCC High Road. A little bit more on that later in the episode. We'll also hear from Sam Bennett in this episode, the Irish sprinter. But first of all, Lionel, what is your weekly roundup, please?
Lots of racing going on. The Tour of Qatar was won by Mark Cavendish, only the fourth overall stage race win of his career. He won a stage. Alexander Kristoff got off the mark for Katusha, winning three stages. Edvald Bosenhagen won the time trial. Good week for Dimension Data. But Bosenhagen lost the overall lead to Cavendish after suffering a couple of punctures. In the south of France, the La Méditerranéenne, as we now have to call it, the Tour of the Med, as I think of it, won by Andre Grivko of Astana. Former Tour de France stage winner Yann Bakelants won a stage, as did Arnaud Démare of Française des Jeux. And it was probably most notable for the fact that in their 20th season, Française des Jeux won their first ever team time trial, something that's got the internet a frenzy this week. In the south of Spain, Philippe Gilbert outsprinted a small group to win the Tour of Murcia, or the Vuelta a Murcia. And Australian Lee Howard got his first victory for IAM Cycling after moving from Orica Greenedge. He won the Clásica de Almería in high winds the following day. But the busiest week of the season is coming up with the Tour of Oman, Ruta del Sol, and the Tour of the Algarve, and a lot of big names in action in the coming week, which we'll talk about in a minute.
Daniel's scowling there like Mark Cavendish fixing a puncture on a very cold day at your mention of Francis Dujou's team time trial victory. Daniel, you up in arms about the frenzy that created, aren't you?
I just saw a lot of reaction on Twitter in particular, suggesting that this was one of the greatest upsets in the history of professional sport. The reality is that FDJ have been making considerable progress in time trials, and particularly team time trials, for a long time. We can trace this back, Richard. Start of 2014, FDJ really made a conscious effort, their coaches, Fred Grapp, Julien Pino, guys we've mentioned on the podcast before, to focus on improving team time trials. And I don't know if you remember, but I made a visit to the FDJ's training camp in the Pyrenees in May 2014, and there was a team time trial. They did a team time trial practice session at that camp, which was interrupted by one of the direct sportifs, Yvonne Madio. He pulled the whole team into a lake by berated them for their lack of application, lack of discipline. He told them to buck their ideas up. Two of the riders actually stormed off, Arthur Vichot and Arnaud Janssen, Janssen, who's now riding for Cofidis, and they went back to the hotel. There was a team meeting later in the day. They were firmly reprimanded for their actions. But this drive to improve the team's time trialing has really paid off. And I know that Fred Grapp and Julien Pino have spent a lot of time with Lapierre, the bike manufacturer Shimano, and working on aerodynamics. And the competition wasn't great, but they are certainly no longer minnows in that discipline.
Well, there you go.
I set him up perfectly, you see.
Absolutely, perfectly.
I'm finished now for the week.
So that's it. Okay, Daniel, you just sit over there for a moment. Was that the training camp where you also got very friendly with Kenny Ellison? I just remember you came back with stories about Kenny Ellison and his interest in art.
Kenny Ellison, who, of course, is recovering at the moment from a very bad knee injury. Had a very nasty operation. He posted pictures on social media a few weeks ago of his knee. It looked pretty grim.
Yeah, I don't imagine that had he been fit, he'd have been a hugely important cog in that team time trial machine either.
What, being little, about 5'2"?
Little Kenny Ellison. Mm. He's a training partner of some guys I was seeing last week in Nice. And Romain Bardet has moved to Nice as well, apparently. But I was down in Nice last week seeing Joe Dombrowski, Ian Boswell and Larry Warbass for a forthcoming Friends special. Maybe mention a bit more about that later on. What else happened last week? Mark Cavendish won the Tour of Qatar. Second time he's won that race, isn't it? Won a stage, but was edged out a couple of times by Alexander Kristoff of Katusha. Katusha also in the news last week for not being banned from competition, as they might have been, having had a second doping positive. Daniel, are you okay there? You seem to be falling apart. Are you okay?
Yep.
So, yeah, so two talking points really from Qatar. Katusha not being banned under the UCI bylaw that allows the UCI to ban a team for two positive tests in a six-month period?
12-month.
12-month period, apologies. Mm. They did have a doping case, of course, last March, but it was retrospective testing from 2012. Mm. Caruso, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Katusha, the team with nine lives, really, aren't they?
See what you did there, Lionel. That was good.
Yeah, I mean,
excellent. Brilliant.
I mean, that's blown it. I don't know what else to say now.
Did you plan that over the weekend?
It just came to me there, honestly. But it is a loosely worded rule, as you say, Rich, and it's they really kind of, if you like, got off on a technicality in the sense that Luca Paolini's positive test during the last Tour de France
was for cocaine,
which was went down as a, although because it was in competition, it's very confusing, isn't it? Because it was in competition, but it's not deemed to be performance enhancing.
He also hasn't been sanctioned yet. I mean, the case is still outstanding, and so that alone, I would have thought, would make it extremely difficult for Katusha to be banned from competition. I think the UCI also have worded that bylaw in such a way that there are three clauses, and it's very vague, and I think any anti-doping rule that is out with the auspices of WADA, that's sort of an add-on, is very easily challenged. We saw that before the 2012 Olympics with the BOA, British Olympic Association, had their own bylaw about banning any athlete who'd served a doping ban was banned for life from the British Olympic team. And that was challenged actually by WADA, because WADA are keen to have a world anti-doping code and for everybody to be following the same rules effectively, and this UCI rule does place the UCI in this sense outside of WADA, and I think, you know, makes it very, very easily challenged, especially in a case where one of the doping cases hasn't yet been concluded.
Yeah, and we mentioned last year the danger of professional cycling becoming even more of a closed shop, particularly the World Tour becoming even more of a closed shop than it is, and in that environment, against that backdrop, the teams policing themselves or the World Tour policing itself becomes very, very important, I think. And particularly when you set the Katusha case against the case, for example, of Androni Giocattoli last year. They were suspended for a month for two positive tests. They were definitely for performance enhancing substances. The intent to improve two riders' performances. But, you know, their riders certainly have been very disgruntled over the last week since the Katusha verdict on the banning of the team was announced. Franco Pellizzotti, I think, tweeted last week that he was pretty disgusted with the decision.
Pellizzotti on the moral high ground. There's an unusual occurrence, because he, of course, has served a doping ban himself. Cavendish, will he be happy, do you think? I think he will be happy. I mean, he wasn't expecting much on the road at this point in the season. He's still dividing his time between road and track. He'll be riding the World Track Championships next month.
Is that confirmed?
I don't know, is it?
No,
is it,
I don't think it's confirmed, is it? But I think it's heavily on the cards that he'll ride the Omnium there. Mm.
But I would have thought so.
We're waiting for confirmation.
He's going pretty well. I mean, Kristoff did seem to have the edge on him, and that's alarming in a sense, because Kristoff would tend to associate with he being a big diesel engine who's better over much longer distances, and he comes into his own in the second or third week of a Grand Tour or at the end of a race like Milan-San Remo. And over these shorter stages, you would perhaps expect Cavendish to have the better of him. But overall, I think he'll be reasonably happy, won't he, Daniel?
I think he's fit. He's very fit. He's done a lot of training on the track, as we've mentioned in previous podcasts. One of the problems he was having, I think, on the track was having to push huge gears when he was doing the team pursuit training. And certainly his performances so far this year tally with that. He has looked strong. He's looked as though his power has been good in sprints, and he's confirmed this himself. His numbers have been good, but perhaps his acceleration isn't at its absolute best. I think he'll be slightly torn, his feelings about winning Qatar, having lost three times to Christoph. I think part of him still wants to be the fastest guy in the peloton or the fastest guy in every race he competes in. But I think he's also very much in a frame of mind of wanting to chalk things off before the end of his career and, you know, stack up more and more wins and different wins. I mean, this is a race he's won before, but just add to and decorate his palmarès further, I think.
Well, another rider competing in Qatar was Irish sprinter from Team Bora, Sam Bennett. And I spoke to him a couple of weeks ago at his training camp in Mallorca. He was good in Qatar, 2 fourth finishes, 6th place and 7th on GC, so a pretty solid opening to the year from him after a good year last year, marked also though by a disappointment at the Tour de France where he struggled for a long time and eventually pulled out. Anyway, I caught up with him in Mallorca and here's what he had to say on the eve of the season. Sam, are you happy with your season last year?
I was happy. Like every year I looked to improve, and I think as a sprinter you want to get results all year long and not just in one period, so I was happy in that respect that I got results throughout the season, but I was disappointed with my tour. I found it a little bit embarrassing, but great experience, and I learned a lot from it, and hopefully this year I can take from that and move forward.
You had a pretty horrific time at the tour, didn't you? You were struggling for a few days. What do you take away from that? What was the problem there?
Got sick, but mudded out, and then I got a hernia in my diaphragm, and I couldn't eat, and was getting these stomach cramps. So I missed 3 weeks of training, and then I had 10 days of getting back, and then I went in with very little form. And then when I was I started the first 2 days, I didn't think I'd get 5 days in. I just kept taking it one day at a time, and yeah, a lot of days when I was trying to recover, or when it was time to recover, I was getting stomach cramps, and then also sometimes I was lucky to get one bar into me in the race, so I was just bonking most days, and I went so deep that I just couldn't keep going after stage 17. And but yeah, I think I learned a lot. I learned how to conserve, and really how if you go too hard one day in the tour, you're not going to get through the next day, so really to learn to stay within my limits, and also I think you learn how to really push yourself and really hurt yourself for a longer duration. Like three weeks is a long time, out of 2.5. Now, when I come to a one day, it feels really short.
I mean, I think people were surprised you kept going as long as you did, especially with the problems that you had. What was it that kept you going, you know, when you were clearly in such bad health?
I don't want to be a bad rider anymore. I want to improve, and I think I was 24 and I needed tour in the legs. I need that strength, and I think, you know, I'm getting to a point now where I stop looking at there's potential, and I really have to start getting the results, and I think it was a big stepping stone. And you know, you go in and you push yourself, and you learn a lot more about yourself. Like I never raced beyond 8 days, and to really push myself beyond, you know, it was yeah. I think I knew it had to be done. It wasn't pleasant, but it was a big learning curve.
So there are still some benefits from getting through that long. What's it like? You know, you're a sprinter. There's a lot of very well-organized teams out there, you know, supporting different sprinters. It's changed maybe from a few years ago when there was maybe, you know, Cavendish's team was very dominant. Now there are lots of well-organized teams. What's it like mixing it with those guys and getting stuck in there, you know, as somebody who's sometimes a lone operator? What can it be? Is it quite intimidating? how do you make your presence felt there without sort of getting in the way of people and things like that?
Yeah, you find like respect comes in, plays a big role in it. I found like, especially say, for example, the start of the year, we went in with a new jersey, new sponsors, and nobody really recognized us. And it was like our respect was gone. And whenever we wanted to do a train, people just kept pushing through the center. And then we got our win in Qatar, and all of a sudden we were more accepted in the bunch sprints, and we got that bit more respect. So I think it comes with, you know, constantly being up there and getting results. But it can be intimidating. Like, you never want to step on anybody's toes, but you don't want to get pushed around either. You have to show your presence, you have to show you're there. And I think when you're consistently getting up there and you're getting good results, then respect comes along and they take you seriously. But it's difficult, you know. You have to try and get your team working well. You have to find out what works best, and it doesn't always go to plan. And it's not something you can train in training. Like, you have to really keep with the same guys and keep doing it in race situation. It's a lot different, so it's a big learning curve. And I'm finding that the leadership role in that part, it is difficult, but I'm learning as I go along, and hopefully this year will be a lot better.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Eurosport, who are sponsoring us along with Trainer Road this year, thank you very much to Eurosport for partnering once again with Cycling Podcast. Coming up this week, they are showing the Tour of Andalusia, also known as the Ruta del Sol, which is a very good field there. A lot of races on this week, as Lionel mentioned at the start. Should just mention about the Sam Bennett interview there. Spoke to Sam Bennett for a long time. He was excellent on the art of sprinting, and some of that interview will perhaps feature in a later Friends special on the art of sprinting. He was really, really good at describing just what it's like in the frenetic final stages of a race, how difficult it is in the Tour de France in particular to just even be there at the finish. I asked him to tell me who he thought was the best lead-out train, and he said Cofidis. He's been very impressed by Cofidis and how well organised they are and how well they do, considering the riders might not be, you know, the best riders in the world, but how well organised they are as a train. So interesting to get that insight. Daniel's looking sceptical. I also asked him, he's from Carrick-on-Shore, of course, and I asked him about his relationship with Sean Kelly, another famous cyclist from Carrick-on-Shore. And it's funny because he rode for Kelly's team, of course, before joining Bora. And, you know, you forget he's so young that he didn't really grow up knowing Sean Kelly as a cyclist. He said, when I was growing up, Sean Kelly was a square in Carrick-on-Shore. He wasn't a cyclist at all. So that was interesting. Anyway, Sam Bennett speaks very well and was very insightful on sprinting, and we'll hear more from him at a later date.
Yeah, born in Belgium, I think, and then lived in Carrick-on-Shore. I think his dad was a lower division Belgian footballer, if memory serves.
That rings a bell. Yeah, could be right. We'll check that.
True.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it's true. I don't doubt you for a second. So races come out this week. It is a very busy week for February, and the top riders sort of spread far and wide. We're going to see Alberto Contador in action, aren't we? We're going to the Tour of Oman, Andalusia, Algarve. Who's riding which? Who's riding where?
Tour of Oman has got Romain Bardet, Vincenzo Nibali, Richie Porte and Dan Martin, according to the provisional start list this is, of course. The Ruta del Sol has got Rafa Majka, Mikel Nieve, Wout Poels, Alejandro Valverde, Bauke Mollema and TJ Van Garderen. And in Algarve, in Portugal, Geraint Thomas, Mikel Kwiatkowski, Fabio Aru, Andrew Talansky, Rigoberto Urán, Kittel, Tony Martin, Thibaut Pinot, Contador and Cancellara. So between those three races, a lot of the big names in action.
To decide which is the most appealing. Obviously, it's the Tour of Andalusia because it's on Eurosport. But
well, definitely, if you can watch it, then that makes it much more watchable, doesn't it?
It does.
Obviously.
It does, absolutely. Anyone catches your eye there, Daniel? Valverde, who normally starts the season motoring, has been obviously very quiet so far, but he's so consistent, but this year is said to be going for the Giro, the Tour and the Olympic Games. Perhaps he's holding back a little bit, is he?
He's always consistent, and you say he's been quiet. That's very relative. The Tour of Murcia in his home city took place this weekend. He was second there behind Philippe Gilbert. Looked pretty strong.
Oops, missed that.
It wasn't on telly.
If it's not on telly, it doesn't happen.
I would suggest he's going all right, Richard. He's going all right. Sporting a new aerodynamic.
Is he? Has he got a new hairstyle?
Well, a non-hairstyle.
Oh, he's just admitted defeat, alas, as he's gone finally the Lionel Burney route. Because he did, of course, have hair implants a few years ago, didn't he?
But yeah, it wasn't well, Verde or me.
Not as successfully as Johan Museo or Wayne Rooney.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
We mentioned at the start that we've got a friend special being released this week. This is our second of the year after Chris Froome behind the scenes in the lab at the start of the year. Thank you to everybody who signed up as a friend. Overwhelming response, and we're very, very grateful to you for that, because it helps us to produce these weekly free podcasts as well as providing you with 11 exclusive friends podcasts. And this second one is a HCC High Road special. I look back at one of the most successful teams ever in cycling, certainly the most successful perhaps of the last 10-15 years. And it was a team that rose from the ashes of T-Mobile, as a lot of you will know, and reinvented itself as a sprinting team that won 70-80 races a year, incredibly successful. And the guy behind it was Bob Stapleton, a Californian billionaire from outside the sport. Not a billionaire, sorry, Daniel. Millionaire.
Yeah.
Multi-millionaire. Always describe him as a billionaire.
I think that was because he sold his business for, I can't remember whether it was 500 billion or 50 billion.
He let that slide though, didn't he?
I don't think he likes being referred to as a billionaire.
All right,
but
okay.
He didn't, to be honest, though, you two never really had the greatest relationship anyway.
We did actually initially. It was only later that unfortunately fell apart. The very wealthy Californian businessman, Bob Stapleton, kind of rode to the rescue and set up this team around Mark Cavendish, Andre Greipel, Gerald Chielek, Edvald Boasenhagen, guys that won a lot of races. Daniel was over in California last year and he went to see Bob Stapleton for, I think, one of the first interviews that he's given since the demise of the team in 2011. Fascinating stuff. Let's hear a little clip from that interview now, and you'll hear the full exclusive interview in our friend special, which will be released later this week. So here is Bob Stapleton.
These were some of the most fun we had, really, in the team, was planning out who could do what and what their potential was and how the pieces of all this could come together. And I think we really enjoyed that as a management team. And it was highly competitive. I mean, guys would keep track of how their guys did versus your guys. And it was, you know, a great competition within the team on who was the best identifier and developer of talent. And we were taking a bet on a bunch of young guys. So why not a Cavendish? You know, you might have thought maybe Greipel or Chielek or somebody else was going to be better, but there was more than enough room in that team for someone like Cav. We were taking experiments on guys like Hansen and whoever, and so I think there was the personality always kind of engaged me with Cavendish, and he had been tremendous in the Tour the year before. We should never overlook that. I had seen him up close and personal in California. I'd spent a fair amount of time with him in camps. He was always kind of a provocative guy, and he had a real edge to show that he could do it. And you have to like that. You just have to like that. And you got to always root for the underdog. So I always felt pretty well connected to Cav. I had seen him. You know, he crashed in California and really tore himself up. It was basically the last lap of a finishing circuit. So he could have easily said, screw it, I'm done. I'm not going to do anything. He fought like a dog. And yes, behind the team car to get back in that race. I never forgot that. The fire and the motivation he had, it just really impacted me, and I think I was a fan from his ever since. To the extent that, you know, we could work through stuff that was less than perfect.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool. Pair your power meter with over 800 workouts and 80 training plans to make you a faster cyclist. Visit trainerroad.com/TCP to try Trainer Road risk-free for 30 days.
Thank you to Trainer Road. Lionel and I are still following the programme. Rob Hatch is still following the programme. And it's all coming to head on March the 31st in Manchester for our race. Still going well, Lionel?
Yeah. Yeah. Keeping going, yeah. Mm-hmm. Bit worried that you two have overtaken me in power output per kilo, so I'm going to focus on losing.
What are you going to focus on? You're changing
your
focus.
More weight in the next month.
Okay, interesting. Okay, interesting strategy. Mm. We'll see how that pays off in Manchester. So, listen, next week we've got our event with Chiro in London, which is sold out, unfortunately. Foyles Bookshop.
Not unfortunately for us. Obviously.
Unfortunately for anybody who might want to go, if there is anybody. But yeah, that'll be fun. We'll record that, and that'll be released as a friend special as well. And We were going to talk a little bit more about the races that are coming up this week. I think you had a bit more to say about that, Daniel, before we wrap things up for this week.
Well, you just look at the strength of the fields, particularly Ruta del Sol and Algarve. You know, these are two races that have struggled in the past few years. They've lost days, they've regained days, they've looked to be on the brink of disappearing at any moment. And here they are with very, very strong fields. The golf races this year, my sense or my feeling is that they've taken a little bit of a knock. They've lost some momentum. You know, we talked last week about Quickstep or Etics Quickstep not going to Qatar this year. There were safety concerns last week in Qatar. There was a very nasty crash. No barriers near one of the finishes. And, you know, Oman, this could be the last year of Oman. Mm. The contract is up. The organising committee is going to decide at the end of the race whether there will be an edition in 2017. So, you know, in a sense, I mean, the purists, the romantics among us will be, we're quite happy to see momentum shifting back towards Europe. Some of these, you know, the traditional heartlands, the south of France has always staged a lot of racing at this time of year. We saw the Tour of the Med make a comeback this weekend. Slightly disappointing that Montferrand, the iconic climb of that race, didn't feature. It's very, very difficult to take. It's always been difficult to take the race up that climb, and problems with safety, problems with local councils, etc. However, good to see that race back. There is more racing later in February in Provence, in the south of France. There's about a week. There are three or two new races. So just interesting to see the strength of those fields. And also, you know, as we say, we seem to say every year now, just to see so many big guns so fit early in the season. You know, TJ Van Garderen in Murcia at the weekend, leading Philippe Gilbert out, looking very, very strong. And we don't really expect to see any of these guys turn up out of shape anymore. We expect them to be firing competitive straight away. You know, Thibaut Pinot's always, he's already looked good in the GP Marseillaise, and, you know, various other Grand Tour riders have already shown good form so far this year.
Which is a throwback, isn't it, to the 80s when good riders were just good riders year round, and there weren't these fluctuations in form that we began to see in the 90s and early 2000s, whatever you want to read into that. We've had a few comments about Lionel's dismissal of the races in Australia, and perhaps we were guilty of that ourselves last week, talking about, you know, Sky's trip over to the Herald Sun Tour. It wasn't so much a comment on Australia as a country or the race, just it seemed an unusual choice. But it did make me think, Lionel, that we do have to make amends to our Australian listeners, to whom we are very grateful and very appreciative. So I think next year we're going to send Lionel to the Tour Down Under. That is, whether we have to crowdfund it or something, I don't know. We'll manage it somehow.
What a punishment that is.
It's not a punishment at all. You'd love it. It's brilliant.
No, I would love it, yeah. Well, our friend Ellis Bacon.
I just hope you return alive.
We'll send him on a Bush Tucker trial to the Tour Down Under.
I'm just more worried about, you know, the reaction you'll get there, Lionel, given your comments.
I need a very wide brimmed hat. It's very hot, isn't it?
With corks hanging off it.
Yeah, it'd be not built for the hot weather.
Stereotypes or anything.
No. But our friend Ellis Bacon went to a couple of days of the Herald Sun Tour. He's now living in Melbourne. He said it was fantastic. So
sure it was.
Yeah. So, it's difficult, though, isn't it? It's very early in the season, and it was just a surprise.
Have you ever been to Australia?
I haven't been to Australia, no.
It's
no,
fantastic, you love it.
Yeah, I'd like to go.
Well, next year it's going to happen. Next January you're going to be there.
Excellent.
If I can just interrupt the tomfoolery, on a more serious point, we've talked a lot over the years about new races, new cycling territories, and the golf races, and certainly to a lesser extent Australia, because cycling seems to be thriving there. But it just proves once again what we're saying about the golf races, that it's a dangerous game, isn't it, to try and introduce cycling to and introduce racing to new territories. And this gravitational pull always seems to bring cycling back to the old heartlands.
Yes and no. I mean, you know, when I've been to the Tour Down Under, the people, there's a big following for cycling in Australia, and so the crowds are huge and enormously appreciative of seeing stars in action. And again, you know, the point you made a little bit earlier about riders being fit year round, they're seeing pretty good racing, and they're seeing the top riders racing well. And so There's definitely a place for that. You know, when you go to Oman and Qatar and Dubai, there are no roadside fans. But I would say that at the Tour Down Under, the crowds are much bigger than at the Tour of the Med or, you know, a lot of these Southern European races.
But the Tour Down Under really is the exception.
Yeah.
You know, we saw this week, we heard that USA Pro Challenge is not going to take place in Colorado, a real hotbed of cycling in the United States. And it's just very, very difficult for new races to earn themselves or to be given maybe 10, 15 years to really solidify, you know, their reputation, their place in the calendar, and really to solidify themselves in the psyche of the local, you know, people and get people coming out, etc. And, you know, they just don't get that time. And 4 or 5 years in, often a sponsor will drop out and there's no one to come in. And that's what tends to happen. Whereas, you know, these races with long traditions, long histories, somehow they cobble it together and they manage to survive.
But as you say, Daniel, the pendulum is swinging back. The Tour of Valencia back on the calendar after a 7 or 8 year gap. The Tour of Murcia has been clinging on, and that might extend back out to a multi-day race. If the races in the Gulf States do disappear, the riders will have to race somewhere. So it will be a boost for some of the ailing races in the more traditional heartland, I'd suggest, or cycling will have to look elsewhere. I mean, you know, Oman and Qatar are joint ventures with ASO. So presumably, you know, if they were to contract or disappear, ASO would have some kind of contingency plan to protect their, you know, their more global ambitions, I suppose.
Yep. Should we wrap up there? Daniel,
just
you got something
else? Final point on that. I think great credit, huge credit needs to go to the people who have, in those places, Spain, Italy, in the face of great economic difficulties in particular, have really dug in, and they've managed to put those races on in great adversity a lot of the time, not ideal circumstances, and they have managed to salvage quite a lot of races. A lot of races have disappeared, but thanks to volunteers, etc., organising committees, you know, we do still have some races in those places.
Absolutely. So listen, let's wrap up there, and we'll return. We tried to keep it briefer this week. I'm not sure if we've achieved that, but you know, do sign up for our friend's special, HCC High Road. It's 90 minutes long, so it's a pretty detailed look at that team. And as well as Bob Stapleton, we've got interviews with Brian Holm, Rolf Aldag and Mark Cavendish in that. So I hope it's a good listen. You can become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. Coming next week, we have special regular episode speaking to Lizzie Armitstead and Lucy Garner. Lizzie Armitstead certainly is writing Het Nieuwsblad at the end of the week, and both will be riding in the inaugural Women's World Tour event, Strada Bianchi in Italy, a week later. Quite a significant moment for women's cycling, so we thought we'd mark that with a special speaking to Lizzie Armitstead, the world champion, and Lucy Garner, the former junior world champion, double junior world champion. Both were absolutely fascinating, so hope you enjoy that. That's all for this week. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.